Taxation number 220099, Rule 9.
Reel 5, side 2, Captain David Render.
Well, there was this terrific stonk, and we couldn't understand what it was all about, and it went on all day. And suddenly, the order came through that everybody got a ceasefire. And as I understood it afterwards, we'd been fighting the 3rd British all day long. Whether any of us inflicted any damage on the others, of course, I don't know. But I don't think we actually did suffer anything particularly special. There was a lot of ammunition fired. But the one thing that it did actually teach us, I suppose, was the weight of our own fire. In other words, what the Germans must have been putting up with, which was miles more than whatever it was they could sling at us. I might tell you that when they got going with their mortars and with their Minenwerfers, because they seem to be the main things they used, especially with that moaning mini noise, where it used to go, it was frightening if you were anywhere near that lot when they came down. For all that, of course, our saving grace on artillery must have been the 25-pounders and the 5.5s. They were the 25-pounders, in many ways, people reckon, were one of the factors of winning the war. I mean, as far as I can see, everything won the war, didn't it? The Jeeps won the war. The Sherman tanks were the finest thing that won the war. The Spitfire won the war. The Bren gun won the war. Everything won the bloody war, didn't it? But I mean, the fact of the matter is that, as far as the Germans were concerned, it must have been very, very tough to have been at the receiving end of the 25-pounders. Now, we go on to by the way, at this time now, we have lost John Semkin because he was invalided back, if you like to use that word, sent home to England because he'd really had enough at Geilenkirchen. And we had a new squadron leader in called Enderby, Bill Enderby, who was in fact wounded on D-Day and came back to the regiment. He was the squadron leader. We then did an advance up to Lochem. And Lochem is a town in Holland. And I, in fact, was allocated the job of doing one of these famous right-handed swoops away from the rest of the squadron to come into Lochem with a sort of southeasterly punch. The four troop was to attack Lochem head on, and five troop I was to come in on the right hand side. The other troops were in reserve. So I set off straight out into through the wood into you can't say no man's land, because we didn't have a line or anything like that. We just moved along. There was our war, of course, at this time wasn't like that. There were just a series of strong points that we ran into all over the place. You could in fact motor for miles and never see a German, of course, at this stage of it, and then suddenly you'd go around the corner and bang, crash, wallop. Anyway, at Lochem, four troop under the command of a chap called Peter Mellows, did a sort of a recce in a wood, or on the edge of a wood, with Lockham straight ahead of him, which was due north. He decided that they were just going to advance straight across this field at the town. There was, in fact, a copse just in front of them. Meanwhile, yours truly, 5 Troop, had swanned off on the right and then did a left hand, which was a westerly turn, towards Lockham. As far as 4 Troop was concerned, they did the advance, much against the advice of the troop sergeant, and unfortunately the Germans were in the copse and they let fly and knocked out 3 tanks of Peter's Mellows' troop, and 2 tanks of Peter's troop, and including the troop sergeant, who was a very old soldier from the desert days, which was a terrible thing, and they got killed, and they are actually all in the Lockham cemetery, the civilian cemetery, because they've been given special permission to keep the chaps there. In the meantime, I was coming in from the easterly direction, and I suddenly found that my tank had sunk into the grassy field in which we were. I tried to keep it up on the bank, but it still went straight down. It happens, of course, very, very quickly in a tank that you get in trouble. You get no warning, you're just stuck, and that's it. Hence the fact that, of course, the Germans aped the Russian tank builders in many ways by widening up their tracks. We tried to widen ours up by putting on what we call spades. They were like little metal plates which were knocked onto the outside track links, so that they widened up the tracks by about 2 or 3 inches. They did make a difference, admittedly, but when you think that the Russian heavy tanks, their KVs and things like that, had tracks which were about 2'6" across at least, you get some idea. They'd probably be more than that, 3 foot perhaps, but I mean, you get some idea of what was really necessary to keep them up. But unfortunately we didn't have anything like that at all. So into the field my tank sunk, and I realised, I could see the town ahead of course, and I suddenly had the feeling in the back of my mind that I was broadside onto the enemy, and as it happened I was about right, because quite quickly we were getting stonked, we were getting shelled. So I immediately gave the order, went out, because the tendency, don't forget, is when stuff starts coming at you, people tend to stick in the tank. It's a debatable thing in many ways, I suppose. Sometimes it's the best thing to do, but in my case, I felt that as the thing was stuck and it was all up. So we pulled out the firing pin out of the main armament, out of the 75mm, spun the radio, and I gave the order, get out, bail out. So we all bailed out, and we ran straight diagonally south, well, straight south, not diagonally, straight south into a wood. And as we ran back, we were now being shelled very heavily with some big, it felt to me like 110 or 120 millimeter rounds, which were falling quite close to us. And suddenly, in front of me, a whole lot of trees all fell down. And I couldn't understand what had knocked these trees down, really, although there was stuff flying about. I mean, there seemed to be rather more than some. When I got there, of course, I realised what it was. It was the top of my tank, which had come over our heads. It had been blown off by one of these rounds which had hit it. And the cupola on the top and the flaps and everything had been sheared straight off and came whizzing over our heads and knocked all these trees down. And I thought perhaps that was another one of my lives that was utilised. Anyway, we then... I did in fact go back to the tank subsequently after a while, and it was very fortunate that I'd said bail out, because the tank was totally wrecked inside and we wouldn't have stood a chance if we'd been in it. So I was quite pleased with that. Now, the point is, it should be mentioned here that the reason why that tank went like that, got stuck like that, was because I had a petrol tank, a Chrysler 5. That was a Sherman tank engine which had five Chrysler car engines mounted on a common crankcase. And the first engine was vertically upright, and the other two were at about, whatever it was, 40, 50 degrees or something, 60 degrees. And then the other ones were correspondingly aiming downwards. And the ones that were, shall we say, at 4 o'clock or whatever it was on the thing, on this crankcase, were, of course, very subject to flooding with petrol. And this is, of course, what happened. The driver, trying to free the tank, stalled the engine, and as soon as you stalled the engine, you couldn't start it again. And so I realised that, and possibly that's what saved us, because I realised he wasn't going to get it started in under about 25 minutes or something, so I said, bail out and leave the damn thing. And, of course, it was just as well I did. Anyway, we got away from that okay, and then got another tank, and we then, by this time, the infantry, I think, had got at... Lockham, because I don't think Lockham was heavily defended. It was defended, but not that bad. Most of it was outside, and of course they expended their energy against us, the Germans had. And because in fact we went in with six tanks and came out with three. We lost three out of the six tanks. Anyway, we then, to give you an idea, it was quite interesting because of an idea of how we had to work, because that would, I think the attack started around about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, if I remember rightly, and then about 11 o'clock or whatever it was, when we sort of collected our wits at the end of this and got ourselves reorganised, we then set off straight away that night to do another one at Hengelo, straight after it. And we went into Hengelo immediately after. The local people, by the way, woke up the next morning to find that the Canadians were there. And so they said to these Canadians, oh, thank you very much for liberating us. And the Canadian bloke said, oh, all right. Well, the fellas, the troops, said, oh, all right. So they said, well, anyway, it's a glass of wine. So they took that, obviously. And they were the heroes of the day. Well, the only thing was that some years afterwards, a bloke who owned, the chap who owned the wood where our chaps had been killed and where they'd been filled in, buried by the padre on the side of the wood as a temporary measure, said, I don't want these blokes on my wood, get them out of it. So they put them into the local cemetery. Well, the local people couldn't understand why it was that who the Sherwood Rangers were, because they phoned up the Canadians because they wanted to know who we were, and the Canadians said, well, we haven't got any Sherwood Rangers. So they said, well, you liberated us and all this sort of stuff. So anyway, they then phoned up the Yanks because they knew they'd got Rangers, and the Yanks said, well, try the British. So they tried us and then eventually found out who we were. And, of course, ever since, they've made a great fuss of us, which is very nice of them. They're very nice people indeed. But they had a big job to discover who the Rangers were, the people.
Can I just ask, when you say that you collected another tank and you make it sound very simple as a process. What actually would happen once you would get back to...
Well, in that case, I would have just kicked the corporal out and taken his tank over.
So you'd have taken pushed a crew out of an existing tank and...
Mm-hmm. Well, you wouldn't normally shove the sergeant out, but you'd shove the corporal out. And don't forget, a corporal was, generally speaking, whilst they were sometimes were very good, they were very much sort of the tagger, the hangers-on on the troop. For instance, we'd put the lance corporal or somebody like that in the 75. Not always. Sometimes they had others, but most of the time that's what I did, and certain other ones in A Squadron did, because the tank was so unhandy. I mean, you might well say, well, why didn't you have the 75? Because it could knock out German tanks. Well, the trouble is that the damn thing had to go along the road and move about with the gun aiming backwards, because it had to be on the cradle to support it, because it would wave about in the breeze. You had to be very careful how you drove it round, unless it was the gun was unsupported. So consequently, we didn't want a tank like that. We wanted a fighting tank. A lot of our lives depended on Bond being alert, if you like a countryman seeing things move in the bushes, or a quick reaction to say, like I did, for instance, I was telling you earlier on about Bricassade. I mean, I just looked round and I saw some movement, and that was it. We fired at it, and those were the blokes who were firing at me. I mean, you had to be quite quick. And of course, don't forget, as far as we're concerned, it was quite an undertaking, because A, we were jolly tired, usually. You were permanently tired. And B, there were lots of periods of time when nothing happened. And so, therefore, when it did happen, you had to be at it.
So, sorry,
we're now at Lockham.
Yep.
So we've taken Lockham. And actually, the only thing I came out of the tank with was that actual map. That's the one I had. That's all I had on me. All my kit and everything else went from Burton.
So you didn't have your own personal kit in a B echelon vehicle somewhere back?
No. It was always on the back of the tank.
Right.
And when they fired at us, they used to set it all on fire. And actually, there is a picture of where 4 Troop went, and there the wood on the right is where they went down and sort of wrecked it, and that pops on the left is where the Germans were.
It's very close country, isn't it?
Yes, but they made a fatal mistake, because Lockham is right over there, you see, and they just drove straight out.
Right.
You shouldn't do things like that. They should have gone round this hedge here. But they were ordered to do it by, if you want the truth, by this Enderby, who wasn't a proper major in my view. John Semkin wouldn't have told us to do that. But he didn't know. He told Peter Mellows, charge. Well, you don't charge in a troop of tanks, it's ridiculous. In fact, that house had this lady in it, who was a young girl at the time, and she took a photograph through that through the doorway of that house, which was that photograph. That was the view from her front door, and she took a picture. And in fact, there are pictures in existence with the tanks and everything that was taken post-war, but she took a picture of the actual tanks there.
You haven't got a copy of that picture?
No, I haven't, but I could get one for you.
No. If you had one hand, it would be interesting to see.
Incidentally, that was our money. Printed by England.
It's Monopoly money, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah. And since we're looking at it, and I was talking to you about Cleve, that is a Daimler.
That's your Humber.
Humber, I mean.
Yep.
Yeah, well, Daimler, Humber.
Can you just say a bit about the propaganda leaflets that I've got here?
Yes.
And how they delivered them, and how and how you responded to them.
Yes. Well, first of all, there would be a sort of plop noise, you see, and it was an airburst. And there were bits of paper flying about. We thought, well, that's very funny. I mean, I wonder what that was. And we just thought that it was a bit of an aeroplane or something, you know, that had blown up. I mean, like bits of flotsam flying about. Well, then we went over to them and we found that they were, in fact, those leaflets. And it happened on two or three occasions, and I just happened to pick those up and kept them in my pocket. But of course, they're laughable, really. I mean, one of those is talking about wear a Stetson hat, which is much lighter than wear a Stetson. By the way, we hardly knew what a Stetson was, but a Stetson, of course, is a trilby hat. But of course, it says it's much lighter than a tin hat, and you ought to wear that, it's easier, and so on. And then the other one, I think, is to do with the fact that, that their favourite one, of course, was to say that it's much better to be in bed with a bird than it is to be fighting the war. And of course, while you're at it, don't forget the chaps at home who are skiving and not in the front are in bed with your girlfriend, you see, and they show a picture of a nude girl or a drawing or something like that. Really, we just took absolutely no notice of it at all. It didn't make the slightest difference. Nothing at all. It was a sort of curious thing. But I mean, if the thing had been of any note or of any interest, I mean, it would have been reported to the squadron leader, if you like, and the squadron leader would immediately report it to the colonel, and there'd be a song and dance.
I mean, how often did you find that this sort of thing was happening?
Infrequently. It only happened once or twice. So I don't know how far away the Germans from us must have been to fire that sort of stuff. They couldn't have been far away, could they?
So once the sort of the battle for Lockham had finished.
Yes.
What happened next?
Right. Just have to be fair. Well. Then we went up to Enschede and Hengelo, and then, of course, we went on through some nasty sort of fighting at places like Kloppenburg and Lingen. And the Americans were around in the Kloppenburg area as well. I remember there was one, and then subsequently we got up to Bremen. But on the way up to Bremen, I remember, there was an occasion when we went over a bridge and there was I hadn't got over the bridge, but Peter Miller's troop had got over the bridge, and there was an enormous explosion. And what had happened was that young sailors had got naval shells which they put underneath the bridges and organised it so that as soon as a tank went across and trembled the valve, the fuse, and set it off, and they blew up I remember one of the 25 pounders complete with all blokes in it and everything. I mean, it was a bit of a terrible thing, really, people flying through the air. But Peter Mellows, he actually saw all this happening. I didn't, but I mean, we were just around the corner sort of thing. Don't forget, we couldn't see all these things happening, but you did know about them. As far as I was concerned, I didn't do anything particularly outstanding at that time. There were various firefights, I suppose you could use that word that the Americans use, but nothing very special. When we got to Bremen, I was ordered into Bremen, and in fact, as I understand it, I was one of the first tanks, if not the first tank, into Bremen. In fact, I went down the street with big tall buildings, and a woman came out and waving her arms at me, and that was a repeat of the one at do that on, I suppose. Anyway, she came out, and so I got them to, you know, pull the tank up and got the driver to switch off. Was ist los? I said, you see, in my best German. And she said, I have guns in here, I have guns, you see. So I said, oh, well, you can't have guns. Well, this is what you do when you're 20 years old. And that was that I jumped out of the tank and said, well, with my pistol drawn. And I said, come on, where are your guns then? So she said, follow me up here, up here. So we went up, believe it or not, four flights of stairs in these flats, and into her flat, which in fact was a very nicely furnished flat. And she handed over to me a 16-bore sporting rifle and a 9mm Beretta. So I said to her, oh, you mustn't have that. I must have those, you see. So she said, yeah, you see. So I said, right, well, you stay here and don't move. Don't go out or anything. Just stay here. Oh, yeah, okay. So with that, I shut the door and went. And I thought afterwards, went, you know, what a twit. I mean, I could have been done in easily, but still. Because if it had got an angry German on the end of that Beretta. Anyway, I swapped the Beretta for a Luger and kept the 16-bore, and I brought it home as my loot, and I have it upstairs at this moment now. Still got it, and it's a very good gun.
Presumably you knew the war was coming to a close at that
yes,
stage.
Yes, very much so.
How did that affect your approach and attitude?
Yeah, well, a very good question, that, actually. The answer was that we just took things very carefully. There was no doubt about it. We realised that it was at the end of it. And also, to be fair, getting near to that stage two, for those of us who'd been at it for some time, i.e., don't forget, I was one of the only ones who were left in the regiment who was fighting in Normandy, who'd been fighting in Normandy, as a troop leader, that is. There were people, of course, obviously in the regiment who'd been in Normandy. I'm not suggesting there weren't that, but I mean, actually in the tank fighting. And so by this time, you were. We had a lot of reinforcement people. But by this time, you were getting to the stage when you were saying, well, I'm not going to take any chances. That's not to say that, in truth, if you were told to get on with it and go and do it, you went and did it, yes. But you did it, in a slightly more circumspect manner. You didn't just go in like that. You made sure you did brass up the area before you went anywhere. There was also, I have to say, thinking back on it, quite a feeling of apprehension when we went into the towns, because you realised, of course, that a tank was very vulnerable from above. I might say that the Germans actually said afterwards that they didn't have tanks in towns towards the end. They wouldn't put them in because the Russians had got blokes with mortars and Molotov cocktails and all this sort of stuff lurking about in the upper stories of the houses. And as the German tanks came, they just dropped something on top of them and set them on fire. Well, of course, we were very aware of this sort of thing. It was quite apparent. The feeling was that it was coming to the end, yes. And I must say that when the end did come, there were sort of very lights being fired into the sky and this sort of thing, and the rumour came through that the war was over, but we really didn't know that it was over. We just didn't have to do another operation. It was as simple as that. And then we went down to Hanover, where I must say I drove straight through the Hanomag works and out the other end, and they got these huge lathes with, well, I didn't realise what they were, but they're like long silver tubes that which were the gun barrels on the lathes where they were turning them up, and they were making these guns and putting them into Panther tanks or SPs or whatever they are, Jag Panthers, and then wheeling them around the corner and firing them straight at us. I mean, there was no messing about. I don't know, half the time they didn't have time to paint them even. And So from that point of view, they fought right to the bitter end. Of course, I always say that the Germans were ever so brave. They didn't get, they didn't give in. They got cut up. They got cut in half. We were then moved over.